Welcome, welcome. Welcome back from that 5-minute break. Good job. How we doing? I feel like we've already met. At any rate, I want to welcome you to week 7 of our series through the book of Ephesians titled, you guessed it, Brand New. All right, we're going to be taking a look at a text today in the book of Ephesians, inspired by God, written by Paul, delivered to us, that it really represents kind of a transition in this book as a whole. If you recall any of the content in this series thus far, what we've heard Paul repetitively tell us is he's been telling us time and time again about God's finished work through Jesus to make all things new, to make people new, to build his church. So we've been really focusing on the what has God done end of the content of this book. And last week, Pastor Ryan walked us through the tail end of chapter 3, verses 14 through 21. And there we hear Paul praying for his people, praying for his church. And the intent of his prayer was that not to change their circumstances or that their lives would get better from a materialistic perspective. But Paul was praying for the church at Ephesus, and his intent, the thrust behind that prayer, was that the church at Ephesus would know God on a deeper, more meaningful, more intimate level. Paul is convinced that knowing God in a deep, intimate way is the only thing that can transform us from the inside out. And so that's what he's praying for the church. And in so doing, he's preparing them in a sense for everything that he's going to lay out in chapters 4 through 6, which happen to be our response, in a sense, it's our response to what Jesus has done to rescue us and restore us. So again, the first 3 chapters, Paul has repetitively reminded us of what God has done to adopt us, to redeem us, to give us a new identity, to give us a new purpose, to welcome us home, to give us a new status. We learn that through Jesus, we've been raised from death to life. And Paul is reminding us again and again that Jesus perfect work is why we have a righteous standing before God, that Jesus' righteousness is indeed our righteousness, that the gospel is the singular hope for a broken humanity. And in laying all that out, what Paul ultimately is saying is we need to know God better. We don't realize how much we need him. We don't realize how much he loves us. And we don't fully realize what he's capable of. And now Paul's shifting gears a little bit, and he's going to show us what it means to be a follower of Jesus. So we'll be working in chapter 4 from verse 1 through verse 16. And essentially, there's a transition from doctrine to duty, from exposition, where Paul's explaining what God's done, to exhortation, where Paul's explaining what we're supposed to do as a result of that. And there's this a little detail I just want to share with you about Paul's context, his circumstances. The guy is writing from prison. And I think there's something to be said for that. And the fact that he's writing from prison indicates that following Jesus has some pretty dangerous implications. And so Paul, the Bible really doesn't really offer us these nice, clean-cut, middle-class solutions to life's problems. The Bible offers us something radically different. And if you remember how Jesus described the Christian life in Luke's gospel, you can find it in chapter 1, verses 12 through 13. Here's what Jesus said about following him in terms of, just outlining the implications there. Now, before I read this text, just know that long term, there's no danger in following Jesus. We all make it, we all win in the end. But short term, there's struggle. There's conflict, there's challenge. And here's what Jesus says, that they will lay hands on you and will persecute you, delivering you to the synagogues and prisons, bringing you before kings and governors for my name's sake. It will lead to an opportunity for your testimony. So at every bend, through every circumstance, good, bad, or ugly, know this, that God always has our best, what is best for us at heart. He always has our best intentions and his best intentions for our well-being in mind. And God is only doing things that ultimately are for our good and his purpose. So Paul, he's there, he's writing from prison. There's something to be said for the fact that he's in prison, that his life hangs in the balance, and that he decides that this is the message that the church needs to hear then. And we believe here at Severn that it's a message that the church needs to hear now. And he's going to begin by urging us to live lives worthy of the calling of which we have been called. And here's what he says. I'm in chapter 4, beginning with verse 1. Therefore, I, the prisoner for the Lord, urge you to walk worthy of the calling you have received, with all humility and gentleness, with patience, accepting one another in love, diligently keeping the unity of the Spirit with the peace that binds us. There is one body and one Spirit, just as you were called to one hope at your calling. One Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is above all and through all and in all. Now grace was given to each one of us according to the measure of the Messiah's gift. For it says, when he ascended on high, he took prisoners into captivity. He gave gifts to people. But what does he ascended mean except that he descended to the lower parts of the earth? The one who descended is also the one who ascended far above all the heavens, that he might fill all things. And he personally gave some to be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors and teachers for the training of the saints in the work of ministry, to build up the body of Christ until we all reach unity in the faith and in the knowledge of God's Son, growing into a mature man with a stature measured by Christ's fullness. Then we will no longer be little children, tossed by the waves and blown around by every wind of teaching, by human cunning with cleverness and the techniques of deceit, but speaking the truth in love, let us grow in every way into him who is the head, Christ. From him the whole body, fitted and knit together by every supporting ligament, promotes the growth of the body for building up itself in love by the proper working of each individual part. So Paul, like I mentioned before, he wants us to know what it means to actively follow Jesus, to live lives that are worth living. And he begins by launching into this discourse about Christian unity. That's ultimately what he's talking about here. And so it begs some questions such as, what does that mean? What does unity mean in general? What does Christian unity mean more specifically? It also begs the question as far as, what are the characteristics of that? What is it going to look like? What's it going to be like to experience Christian unity? And then in addition to that, what's the whole purpose behind it? Why? Why is God creating unity? Why is Paul even talking about unity? What's the big idea there? And so in a broad sense, here's what I believe Paul envisions about Christian unity, or Christian community. You could think of it as that as well. Paul sees Christian community as a unified people. These are people who stand for each other, not against each other. These are people who pick each other up. They don't throw each other down. These are people who gather together despite the fact that they hail from diverse cultural, socioeconomic, linguistic, ethnic backgrounds. This is a diverse array of people that are coming together as a direct result of what Jesus has done in their lives. It's a place where pretending can be put to an end and we can actually be the people that we are. We can show people who we really are. We can be vulnerable. We can be honest. We can be open. We can hear the truth. We can speak the truth. We can do it openly and honestly with one another, because ultimately, we love each other, we care about each other, we have each other's best interests in mind. This is what Paul envisions. And ultimately what he's saying is the church, when unified, it's a people who are coming together in absolute and utter weakness to celebrate God's strength, to celebrate what God has done that none of us were capable of doing. It's a group of people that are coming together to say, we need God more today than we needed God yesterday. It's a group of people who are continually rediscovering the gospel, being reminded that we were so broken that God had to send his son to die for us, yet God loved us so much that he sent his son to die for us. So Paul envisions Christians who are united in this, that Jesus is our righteousness, our full and complete righteousness, that Jesus has bore the weight of all of our sin, not just some of it, absolutely all of it. And that's even like the deepest, darkest parts of it that some of us have never even told anyone about. It's all of it. And Paul is convinced that this unity, it has a starting point, and it starts with humility. And so the first point that I want to just present you with, the first big idea that I want to present to you this morning, is that unity begins with humility. So listen to what Paul says in verse 1. He says, "Therefore I, the prisoner for the Lord, urge you to walk worthy of the calling you have received, with all humility and gentleness, with patience, accepting one another in love, diligently keeping the unity of the Spirit with the peace that binds us." So Paul's taught these people, he's prayed for them, and now he's urging them to do something. And the thing that he's urging them to do, the thing that he's urging us to do, is to be unified. And I don't know about you guys or where you live, but where I live, there's a ton of disunity going on, a ton of discord. And we could talk about that in the church, people that don't get along. We could talk about that in the context of our family constellations. You know, the struggle is real in the context of any family, if we're honest with ourselves. There's an ebb and flow between days where you feel like, hey, we're unified, and days where you feel like you're not. And I'll just give you a working example of that. So I'm a father, meaning that I have small kids that are not always on board with the unity that we're trying to create. You tracking with me, parents? All right, so what this means is that at any given moment of the day or night, because granted, you are on the clock 24/7, it never lets up, any given moment of the day or night with little people that are dependent on you for absolutely everything, you might feel like you've been held hostage or like you've been taken as a prisoner. And they're shoving toothpicks in your eyes to make you stay up late. And then they're waking you up early in the morning telling you to make them breakfast. And granted, I love my kids to death, but it's in those moments where you're like, okay, we got to retreat. Where's my wife? Because we got to do this together. This is the only way we're going to win. All right? But the point I'm trying to make is we live in a broken world where disunity is a real thing that we experience. I mean, have you tuned in? We're in an election cycle. People are getting along real well. I mean, it's just smooth sailing. Everybody agrees with everybody. I mean, what I'm really saying is we draw lines. We pick a team. We play for that team. We hate all the other teams. Because in a sense, we're playing against all the other teams. And so Paul, he's telling us to be unified, to preserve unity, to fight for unity. And quite frankly, I think he's lost his mind, because this is not an easy thing to do. It's not something that we can plausibly achieve, even on the small scale of our family structures, let alone the large scale of a country or a church. But Paul is urging us to be unified despite the disunity. So the question becomes, like, why? Like, why can't people just get along? Why can't people just be united? And I got somebody raising their hand in the back, and it's more of a rhetorical question. So I'm going to go into something there. Hopefully I'll answer that question. But here's why. First and foremost, we're broken. Right? Sin broke everything. It broke relationship. It broke us. Whereas we were created in God's likeness and image to be unified not only to God, but to other people and the world that God had created, all of that gets ravaged by sin. And so what the outcome is, we, by happenstance, we've become very self-centered, meaning that we're very focused on our wants, our needs, our desires. We associate value with things, and then we end up pursuing things that we think are valuable. We avoid things that we think don't have value. We gravitate towards things that are going to give us social status or credibility or an applause. We avoid things that are going to create a sense of conflict. So in other words, we gather with people who agree with us. We tend to avoid people who disagree with us because we're self-centered. We're trying to get something out of the relationships that we're navigating. We're not trying to bring something to the relationships that we're trying to navigate. We tend to be a very self-absorbed people. We live in an individualist culture where we're told to do you, do me, do whatever you want to do, but pursue you. Like that's one of the standing orders. And so we've grown to be very self-absorbed people. And what that translates to on one level is we have a hard time when we make mistakes. We have a hard time admitting that we've made a mistake. So even when we're wrong, sometimes we defend ourselves ad nauseum just because we don't want to be wrong. We want to feel like we're right. So ultimately, our self-centeredness, what it drives us to want is we want to feel important, we want to feel heard, we want to feel accepted, and we want to feel, ultimately, we want to feel loved. And that's why unity is so hard, because there are people, and I mean, I'm sure you're thinking of somebody that has made you feel unloved, unaccepted, invalidated, whatever the case may be. There are people in your life that you just don't want to do life with, if you're being completely honest. Because doing life with them is going to require that you get really, really vulnerable. And we don't do vulnerability well because we're self-centered. We look to protect ourselves before we look to serve other people. And this is one of the reasons why Paul is telling us to accept people with humility and love, with patience, in the unity of the Spirit that binds us. Because Paul wants us to know that the only way to connect with other people, the only way that we can be united as a church, as followers of Jesus, is if we start with humility. And humility, what it really is I am putting the interests and the needs of others before my own interests and needs, even when I'm operating at a disadvantage. So it's me being willing to be disadvantaged to advantage other people. This is what Paul is talking about when he's saying humility. And he's not just saying, hey, it's a passive thing that you may or may not do any given day of the week. If you look at the Greek word that he uses there when he says urges, he's emphasizing the importance of us preserving unity, fighting for unity, striving toward unity. And it's a pour everything you got into upholding unity in the context of the church that God is building. It's a continuous, diligent action. It's all your might, all your sentiment, all your attitude poured into preserving unity amongst God's people. It's with humility driving you at all costs, upholding humility. And here's why I believe Paul is saying this. If we look at how Jesus exhibited humility, how Jesus ultimately pursued unity in the context of the people that he is drawing to himself, here's what we're going to run into. And Paul, he communicates with the church at Philippi in his letter to the Philippians. And one of the things that he says to them is he's urging them to imitate Jesus, to follow Jesus, to be like Jesus is what he's saying. And he says, do nothing out of rivalry or conceit. I mean, I think we all failed there, because I definitely have done everything, for the most part, out of rivalry or conceit. I want to feel important. I want to do things that are important. I want an applause. That's rivalry. That's conceit, in a basic sense. He's saying, consider other people and their interests as more important than your own. Put the interests of other people first, even if it disadvantages you, even if it costs you something, even if it costs you everything. Paul says these things, and then he starts pointing to Jesus. And he says, look at Jesus fully accomplishing what I'm talking about. Look at Jesus fully accomplishing humility. And here's what he says about Jesus, that Jesus had equal status with God. Jesus is God. Jesus is absolutely God. He's fully God who became fully man. And here's what Jesus did. He abandoned the place where he lived. That's heaven. That's like the best case scenario. That's better than the best day you've ever had. That's better than the best life you've ever imagined. Jesus abandons that. He's not clinging to his identity as being fully God. He becomes a man. And he enters a world that's absolutely and utterly broken. That's humiliating at that point in time. You even look at Jesus' birth story. There's really nothing beautiful about it. He's born in a barn where animals are using the bathroom. He's laid in a little manger that has hay in it, and we have like these quaint renderings of what that might look like. But there's nothing happy about that. I'm sorry. Like, I can't even imagine one of my kids being born and then be like, "Hey, we're going to take him to the barn." Or, "Hey, honey, we're going to the barn." Pregnancy number 5, got to go back to the barn. Like, that doesn't even make sense. Like, this is Jesus entering humanity, taking the status, the Bible says, of a slave and becoming human, putting on human flesh. Like, there's nothing beautiful about that. That's Jesus humbling himself, willing to be humiliated. And why? So that we can gain an advantage. And Paul goes on and he says, Jesus didn't just become human. He lives a perfect, obedient life. Like, he does everything that the Bible requires of anyone who's ever lived. He does that. He fulfills the law. He fulfills the prophets. He fulfills all of the commandments. He leads a perfectly obedient life. And then to take it one step further, he doesn't just stop there. He dies what the Bible calls an obedient death. And it's not just any death. The Bible says that it's a selfless, obedient death, and the worst kind at that, a crucifixion. This is the kind of humility that has secured unity for God's church, for God's people. And it's very clear that we in and of ourselves are not capable of securing unity, nor are we capable of maintaining it in and of ourselves. But it is very clear that God is highly interested and has promised to uphold and maintain unity in his church. So the next time that you get wrapped around the axle or you're confused as to why people in the church are wrong or why they sound hypocritical or why people say things that hurt my feelings or why people are continually doing things that are a poor reflection on me, the next time you get wrapped around the axle about that, preach the gospel to yourself. That you were in a pit and God pulled you out. And you have no business looking down in the pit and waving your finger to the people who are still there. And you have no business waving your finger to the people who were on the edge of that pit only because God pulled them out too. The next time you get wrapped around the axle about what people are doing to you, preach the gospel to yourself. And I'm not saying ignore it and don't deal with it, but first and foremost, preach the gospel to yourself, because your response to that type of behavior, the play that God gives you is forgive them. Forgive them. And the next time that you're looking at your failures in the eye and you're coming to terms with the reality that you have dropped the ball, that I have dropped the ball, that we have all fallen short of the standard that God has set, the next time you come face to face with that, remind yourself that Jesus has never once asked you to justify yourself, but that Jesus has fully justified you through his righteous, perfect, finished work. Remind yourself that Jesus is not asking us to be perfect. He's telling us that he is going to perfect us. He's promised that. And he's only asked us to trust in his perfect work. Jesus is not asking us to be righteous. He's asking us to freely accept his righteousness as our own. Remind yourself that Jesus became utterly insignificant, dying a public, shameful, disgusting death so that you could have absolute significance. What Paul is saying is that the search for significance through the things that you do or don't do, or the relationships that you want to have and don't have, or the relationships that you do have, he's saying the search for significance through any other means is over. It ends in Jesus, because Jesus is giving us absolute significance. Here's the reality when it comes to unity in the church. Jesus has worked harder than we will ever work. And he's calling us to pour ourselves into preserving what he's guaranteed that he's going to preserve. He's just asking us to try. He's saying, try to live a life of humility. And when you fail, lean on your identity that's fully established in me. He's saying, try to be nice to people that hurt you. And when you fail, lean on your identity that's in me. He's saying, preach the gospel to yourself. Because that's the only thing that can change us from the inside out. And that's the only thing that can create the unity that the Bible talks about with regards to the church. And so ultimately, we're called to preserve unity. Because unity is God's plan for His people. So listen to what Paul says. And we'll pick up in verse 4. He says, there is one body and one spirit, just as you were called to one hope at your calling. One Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God, and the Father of all, who is above all and through all and in all. And so Paul wants us to know well and to know clearly that unity is God's plan for His people. And the reason why it's God's plan for His people is because God, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, the triune God, is the exemplifier of perfect love, of perfect oneness, of perfect unity, of perfect Christian community. God's identity is unity. God, as the triune God, His identity is unity. He's made us in His likeness and image. We're broken. He's remaking everything so that it's new and reoriented to Himself. So what God is doing is He is uniting us as believers the same way that He is united as a triune God, as one God. So church, we are one people. And you'll hear the language that Paul uses. He talks about the church growing into the mature man. That's Paul talking about corporate church. He's not just talking about individuals. He's talking about individuals who together make up what is known as the church universal. So God, the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit is the perfect image of oneness, of love, of unity. And here's the thing. What he's asking us to preserve in unity, it's not vulnerable or fragile. God has, that's what God is. So there's no way that what God is building is going to be anything other than that. Now you may be thinking, well, you know what? I go to a real church that's filled with real people, and these people, you know, they drive me nuts. Some of them are hypocritical. Some of them, I don't even know if they really believe the gospel. And I'm not saying you're wrong, you're right. And we'll get to that. Because the reality is, the struggle is real. We are this side of heaven living in a broken environment. All the while, God is working through that to make us into who we should be. And so this truth that unity is God's plan for His people, not only should it drive Christian community inside the church, it should also fuel the church's mission out there as we interact with people. Now, to paint a picture of that, we're going to go back to chapter 2 in Ephesians. And basically what you have there is this dilemma that's created by race. And the church at Ephesus has asked a question, and the question hinges on race relations. And what they're saying is, can it be that people of other races outside of the Jewish race can be a part of the church that Jesus is building? And the answer is a resounding yes. Because what God is doing is He is granting all people, people who the Bible describes as having been far off. That might be socially, that might be culturally, that might be economically, that might be racially. Whatever that far off barrier might be, through Jesus, God is welcoming people to have access to Himself. And He's making diverse peoples converge to create one new man, the church. So in other words, the uniqueness of Jesus, the fact that there's one God, one Spirit, one faith, not only is it the foundation of unity inside the church, but it should fuel the mission of the church. To proclaim that Jesus is still rescuing sinners. He's still transforming lives. He's still making people new, regardless of their background, regardless of how broken they may be, regardless of how long they may have been addicted to drugs or sold out on the fact that there's something they have to pursue to preserve their own identity or create a way for themselves. Regardless of all of that, regardless of the ways in which we've tried to create our own identity and security, what God is doing is He is uniting people to Himself. One people. People from all over the place, all backgrounds, all races, all linguistic groups, and He's forming one cohesive people group through His finished work. And so, based on what Jesus is doing, we should be propelled into action. And the reason is, we know that people, generally speaking, they seek to be loved and to be accepted. And so as they bear witness of the way that people in the church, followers of Jesus, love and have accepted each other, they bear witness of a God who absolutely is head over heels in love with people and willing to do whatever it takes to rescue them. Paul articulates this for us, this what God is doing through the church. If you look at Romans chapter 10, verses 12 through 15, and here's what he says. He says, "For there is no distinction between Jew and Greek, for the same Lord is Lord of all, abounding in riches for all who call upon Him. For whoever will call upon the name of the Lord will be saved. But how are men to call upon Him in whom they have not believed? And how are they to believe in Him of whom they have never heard? And how are they to hear without a preacher? And how can men preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach good news." So the truth that there is one God, one faith, one baptism is a truth for us inside the church that should fuel our mission outside the church. It's the foundation for unity here and the foundation for our work out there. Because since there is one God, there's one God. We should be diligent in proclaiming to the masses that God loves them so much that He came for them, to rescue them, to make them new, to make them into the people that they've always desired to be. So ultimately, we can maintain unity inside the church that propels the mission of the church. And the reason for this is because unity is empowered by God's gifts. We're going to pick up in verse 7, and there we read, "Now grace was given to each one of us according to the measure of the Messiah's gift. For it says, when He ascended on high, He took prisoners into captivity. He gave gifts to people. But what does 'He ascended' mean except that He descended to the lower parts of the earth? The one who descended is also the one who ascended far above all the heavens, that He might fill all things. And He personally gave some to be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors and teachers for the training of the saints and the work of the ministry to build up the body of Christ." So Paul is clearly saying that Jesus gives us gifts, but he's also told us that ultimately Jesus is the gift. He is the ultimate gift that we have ever received. And so this side of heaven, God may not give you the health that you want. He may not answer that long list of prayer requests. He may not give you the wealth that you desire, or the social status that you desire, or the job that you desire, or the calling that you desire. But you can be guaranteed of this, that God in Jesus has given you Himself. And I'm sorry to say, or break the bubble, my friends, but there is nothing that surpasses that. There is nothing better than God giving you Himself. You on your best day is not better than God giving Himself to you. Your best case scenario pales in comparison to God giving Himself to you in Jesus. This is like the most amazing truth that exists. And it's our job as Christians, just wrap your mind around that every day until you die, because you're never going to fully understand how amazing this is. And there's this clear distinction that we can make as a result of what God is doing and giving himself to us. If you look at other religious practices, other religious systems, ultimately, unlike God, what you're going to run into, the God of the Bible, the God that we serve, you're going to run into gods who we could describe as takers. These are gods who give you a long punch list of things to do, of places to go, of people to see. And in so doing, what those gods are saying is, this is how you earn my love and acceptance. But Jesus freely comes and he gives himself to us. Jesus is not taking anything from us other than our sin. And he's freely giving himself to us because our God is a God who gives. And he doesn't just give, he gives all of himself to us. So in verse 7, when Paul is talking about Jesus' gift, know that Jesus is the ultimate gift. That Jesus' righteousness is our righteousness. And so we don't have to exhaust ourselves trying to earn our keep with God or trying to gain God's love and acceptance. Instead, we can be poured out because we already have God's love and God's acceptance. We are already fully loved and fully accepted by the God of the universe. There is nothing that trumps that. There is nothing that's better than that. But as Jesus continues his work to build the church, he's uniting people from diverse cultures, temperaments, personalities, ethnicities, linguistic backgrounds, social backgrounds, economic backgrounds, educational backgrounds. And he's welcoming people into the context of the church. And he's equipping us, each one of us, with gifts. This is an all hands on deck thing when you're thinking of the church. And the reason why he's giving gifts is because Jesus is trying to make us more like himself. And we are guaranteed that ultimately we will be like Jesus because Jesus is the author and the perfecter of our faith. It's a guarantee. Nothing can stop it. Jesus is going to make us into the people that we should be. And he happens to be using gifts. So he is empowering unity in the church through the giving of gifts to people like you, to people like me. And if we zoom in on what the word equip there means, or the word training that is in some translations, what that word implies that there is something broken that needs to be fixed, which personally I think is kind of weird because Paul's been telling us all along, you've been made new, you have a new identity, you have a new status, and here he's implying that the church is broken. He's implying that although you have a new identity and although you have a new status, there's still something to be had. There's still some headway to be made. There's still some change to be experienced in our personal lives and in our lives together as followers of Jesus. That word equip implies that something is lacking, that something is broken. And the fact that the response to the something is broken or something is lacking is God giving gifts is the fact that God is using gifts. He's using the gifts of people like you and like me to make us into the church, into the people group that we're supposed to be. So Jesus is using us. He's using the people in this sphere of influence to make us more like him so that we can be the church that he's called us to be. And if you look at verses 11 and 12, Paul gives us a list of gifts. And generally speaking, all of those gifts or each of those gifts that he lists would fit into the category of teaching gifts. He says things like apostle. Paul's an apostle. He writes this letter. He's using this letter as a teaching mechanism. He lists pastors and teachers. He lists prophets and evangelists. All of those roles are teaching-oriented roles. And so God uses teaching-oriented roles to equip the church, to prepare the church to be what it's supposed to be and to do what it's supposed to do. But you might be sitting in your chair thinking, well, I am never going to strap a microphone to my face and stand on a stage and tell people what the Bible says. You might be thinking, I'm not a teacher. I'm not a pastor. I'm not an evangelist. I'm not any of those teaching-oriented gifts. And the good thing there is, if you do some reading, Paul By way of his other writings, he outlines a more comprehensive list, and he lists things such as the gift of mercy, the gift of discernment, the gift of knowledge. And then he goes and he says the gift of hospitality. And he talks about the gift of just doing good things, being nice to people. And so there's this broad spectrum of labels that Paul applies to these gifts. And the intent is never for us to read a list like this and be like, ah, those are the only options. I don't meet any of those criteria. I guess I'm just going to be a consumer Christian. Like, that's not the intent there. The intent there is Paul is not blowing out an exhaustive list of things to do inside the church. He's giving us some generic rail so that we understand that God is doing something huge in the church, and he's doing it by way of the gifts that he gives to people. Now, if we zoom out and we look at all of these gifts collectively, the one objective conclusion that we can make about gifts that God gives is that they are always for the service of other people. They are always to be other-focused. They are always given so that you can give them out. God is equipping people with gifts so that those people can have a role to play in the lives of other Christians, other followers of Jesus, so that we can become the people that God has called us to be. And we know that in this text, Paul is clearly talking about people who have gifts. That's what he's highlighting. But as a side note, I'd like to just argue that it's dangerous if we leave it there. It's dangerous if we look at people as people who have something. Because when we find out that people have something is the moment we start networking those people. We're good networkers. We're self-centered. And we gravitate towards people that afford us social status, or maybe they afford us a better reputation, or maybe we just feel morally better when we're around those people. Those are people that maybe we think they hold us to a higher standard. So I'm a better person when I'm around so-and-so because they actually believe the Bible and I really don't. We gravitate towards those people. Now the challenge is there's no real relationship there. That's called networking. That's self-centered. And it's not an exhibition of humility. And that's what Paul blew out the water at the beginning of this text, as he said, with all humility. So the punchline here is God gives gifts to people like you and me, but we are never to value those gifts more than we value the God who gave them, is the first layer of that. And the second layer of that is, nor are we to value them more than the people who have them. Because when we begin valuing the gifts more than we value God and more than we value the people, all we're doing is self-serving. We're trying to get another something. But on the contrary, if we begin valuing people aside from their gifts, aside from their activities, aside from their capacity to do things, we can begin loving and appreciating people for who they are, not what we get from them. And this is important, and here's why it's important. If you didn't believe me. All right, I'm 35 years old, okay? Some of you are older than me, way older than me, all right? Where I'm going with this is, we all experience this thing that we like to call our prime, and we hate leaving it. All right, some of us are still in our prime, potentially, and maybe that's physically or spiritually or whatever. I'm not going to add any other labels there. But some of us feel like we're in our prime. Some of us feel like our heyday is over. And some of us are like, man, when am I ever going to have a prime? The reality is this. Your prime is going to end. You're going to get to the mountaintop, and you're going to peak, and then you're going to start coming down. And what's going to happen is you're going to start going through an identity crisis. And the reason we go through the identity crisis is because we like to think of ourselves based on what we do. Like that we self-describe as, hey, I am such and such. And you can fill in the blank with any of the things that we do. Maybe you're an IT. Maybe you're the president of a company. Maybe you're a pastor of a church. Or maybe you're something that you believe has credibility. And so you introduce yourself as such. The reality is that window opens and it closes very quickly. And that's the time during which you actually are that. You're actually doing that. And you're going to get to a point where you can't contribute the way that you previously contributed. And the question is, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? Are you going to believe that you're somehow less valuable or you're less important or you're less needed? Here's the thing, church. Our value is not based on our activity. Our value is based on our identity in Jesus. So when you're looking at those droopy cheeks and those wrinkles and you're remembering what you did and kind of reconciling what you can't do, it's okay because your identity is fully forged in the person and work in Jesus, of Jesus. It has nothing to do with your accomplishments or your failures or how people perceive your accomplishments or failures, or how people quantify your contribution. It has nothing to do with that. It has everything to do with what Jesus has fully secured through his perfect work. Jesus is your identity. Your gift is nothing more than your activity. It's the thing that you get to do this side of heaven. It's Jesus who explains who you are. Your gift helps clarify what you do. It's as simple as that. And you are who Jesus says you are. Your identity is in your relationship with him. And your activity, the things that you do, should stem from that relationship, should be driven by that relationship, should be fueled or empowered by that relationship. So gifts are not meant to define us. Nothing else out there is meant to define us. Only Jesus is meant to define us. Gifts are intended for equipping people to become active agents in what Jesus is doing to build his church and to radically transform the world. Jesus equips people to play a role in building the church. This is an all-hands-on-deck movement that requires everybody. And you might be thinking, I don't know if you want to say that because I don't think everybody fits the mold. And maybe you have a list of people that you really... like, they're just fringe people. You really don't want to do anything that's important with them because they let you down. The reality is this, that God is calling people, all kinds of people, all kinds of crazy, all kinds of weird. And when revival happens, it gets dirty and messy. And he's bringing all those people together and he's saying, you know what? I'm going to unite these people somehow. And we step back and we're like, there is no way you are uniting that. But that is what Jesus is doing. And as he does that, the burrs, they're wiped off of us. Those rough edges are smoothed out. And we actually start believing the gospel. Because we see people that seem so lost and so out there change. But the big thing that we see is we see our heart change. We see our focus change away from, well, if those people come to my house, it's going to be really awkward and weird and they're never going to leave and I'm going to be forced to have conversations that I don't want to have. I mean, these are the things that go through my head. I don't know if you guys are anything like me, but that's kind of how I'm like, oh, well, I'll invite them. Because I don't want to be stuck. I don't want to be inconvenienced. I don't want to be vulnerable. And what I'm ultimately saying is I don't really want to contribute to what God is doing to unify the church. A bunch of weird people that somehow are being molded together, being brandished for the work of God in the world. So we've heard how unity begins with humility. It's God's plan for his people, and that unity ultimately is empowered by God's gifts. And the final idea I'd like to present to you is that unity is God's method of maturing his people. We're picking up in verse 13 where Paul says, until we all reach unity in the faith and in the knowledge of God's Son, growing into a mature man with the stature measured by Christ's fullness, then we will no longer be little children tossed by the waves and blown around by every wind of teaching, by human cunning, with cleverness in the techniques of deceit. But speaking the truth in love, let us grow in every way into him who is the head, Christ. From him, the whole body, fitted and knit together by every supporting ligament, promotes the growth of the body for building up itself in love by the proper working of each individual part. So Paul opened up chapter 4, urging us to strive for unity with all our might, because ultimately it is through unity that we become mature. That's what Paul's been driving at the whole time. It is through unity, through interacting with the people of God in a deep, meaningful way, that we become the people that we are called to be, that we mature as followers of Jesus. And what Paul is really saying here by way of implication is, I believe this wholeheartedly, that you can be a follower of Jesus and live in isolation in a cave somewhere and never communicate or interact with other Christians or other followers of Jesus. You can have your nose in the Bible 24/7 and you can know all the right things to say. But Paul is saying, good luck maturing as a follower of Jesus outside the context of what Jesus is doing through the local church. He's saying you can be a believer in isolation, but you cannot mature in isolation, because something happens when the people of God come together and believe God together. Something special happens. And maybe you're thinking, well, a lot of weird things happen too. And you're right, a lot of weird things happen. But God is doing something through the weird to make something awesome. So, our relationship with Jesus cannot mature in isolation. It cannot mature outside of the context of the church. And the other thing that Paul is implying here, he says, we will no longer be like little children. Like, he's part of the we. What Paul is saying is that all Christians everywhere, regardless of you've been following Jesus for 10 years, for 20 years, for 100 years, or for 10 seconds, he's saying that all Christians everywhere struggle with a degree of immaturity when it comes to following Jesus. That no one has arrived. Paul never says, hey, look at me, I've arrived. But he always and consistently proclaims Christianity as a process. He says it's Christianity in a basic sense is us continuously becoming who we already are. We're already completely new in Jesus, but Jesus continues his work through us to make us into the people that we're supposed to be. Paul is saying that every follower of Jesus has a shade of immaturity to them. So, when you step foot in a church the next time, just want to encourage you a little bit, and you see someone who's acting immature, don't let your hair fall out or your face melt off. Don't act confused, because you know now. Okay? We don't have to be confused about that and be like, oh, so and so and such and... Like, we can just stop, because we know that all the while I'm pointing out immaturity there, I have immaturity in me. And so here's what this means. Don't be confused by someone else's immaturity and grab yours by the neck and slam it to the ground and deal with it. It's a green light to deal with your own immaturity, and it's a green light to help people work through theirs, not condemn them because of it. So listen to what Paul says in verse 14. Then we will no longer be little children, tossed by the waves and blown around by every wind of teaching, by human cunning with cleverness and the techniques of deceit. Paul is saying that when he rescues us and he fills us with his spirit, we're like little babies, we're like little kids. And this is funny to me because I have little babies and little kids. And the last thing I want is for them to stay a little baby and a little kid that is fully dependent on me and my wife. And there's two reasons for that. One of them is real practical. We are getting older. We're not going to be able to do what we can do today, tomorrow. Like, these people got to grow up. The other one is, I think that my 12-month-old has something more to say than this, like, crazy pterodactyl scream that she makes. I think that she has other important things to say. So I'd like to see her mature. And like, I really just want to see, like, my dream for my kids is to see them develop into the people that God has made them to be. And what that means is they actually have to grow up. And what this means for us is what Paul is saying is we actually have to grow up. We have to move from where we are to where we're supposed to be. And it's incremental, and it's day by day, it's moment by moment, but there should be forward progress. We call this sanctification. It's us becoming more like Jesus. And we're learning here that we only can do that in the context of the church through the gifts that God gives to the church. And as we mature, we become more discerning. We make better decisions, hopefully. And I'm not talking about getting older. I'm talking about maturing spiritually. So getting older doesn't necessarily make us more mature. It just makes us old, and we seem way more immature. People are a lot more judgmental with older people who make bad decisions. Just saying. We become less self-conscious about the way that people are prodding us and poking us and making us feel bad or hurting our feelings. We're less focused on that and more focused on being a rock-steady follower of Jesus who is convinced that their identity is completely secure in what Jesus has done. We endure things. We become more consistent. We don't just attend a Sunday service and say a good word. And then you're like, there's no application in your personal life. You're just like, that was a great sermon. Yeah, because that definitely was the application point. Good job. Like, the application is never a great sermon. The application is let God wreck you. Because in him wrecking you, he's building you up. God wants to change you from the inside out. We become less focused on our image and more focused on serving others. More willing to be vulnerable. And this doesn't mean that we go around ignoring our circumstances. What it means is that we lean on God, we trust God through our circumstances, knowing that he always has our best interest at heart. He always has our good in mind when he's doing the things that he does and allows us to experience the things that we experience. So what Paul is highlighting here is that followers of Jesus are to a degree characterized by spiritual immaturity. So don't be surprised by other people's spiritual immaturity. Help them through it. And don't disregard your own. Work through it. And Paul tells us how we do that. And here's what he says in verse 15. He says, "But speaking the truth in love, let us grow in every way into him who is the head, Jesus." What this means, ultimately, is that we can't truly be united as followers of Jesus outside of Jesus' saving work, and outside of us functionally speaking the truth in love to one another. And I'm talking absolute honesty that's enveloped in true love, care, and compassion. Speaking the truth in love is the Christian practice that Paul gives us as the means by which we can mature. Because here's the thing. Here's why the two go hand in hand. The truth without love is deadly. I mean, tell me you haven't been there. Somebody comes, they just lay into you and they're like, boom, here's why you're wrong. And you're like, can't even breathe. And that leaves you feeling hopeless. Like, what do you do after that? You're just like, man, that guy doesn't like me. And I'm broken. And now what? And then on the other hand, you got the nice people that are like, I really don't want to offend anybody and I just want to encourage people and I want to keep the peace. And so you're really, really nice. And what you end up doing is you're affirming everything that's wrong with people. We don't need to be affirmed in our flaws. We need to be affirmed in the fact that God poured himself out for us. That's the only thing that I need to be affirmed in, is that God loves me so much, he's not going to let me slip away from him. Truth without love is harsh because we're left with information that we can't even readily apply. And the love without truth, it leaves us hopeless because we don't even know what to deal with. We're just like, wow, I'm amazing. Unless you have the two together perfectly balanced, it doesn't work. And so I'm going to encourage you that there is not a person in this room that can do this. Like, this is impossible. This is mission impossible for us. And if you're like, no, I got this nailed, it's mission impossible for us. I'm convinced of that. There's not a person who knows how to do this the way that God does it. And here's why. We withhold the truth because we don't want to offend people. We don't want it to be reflected on us that we said the wrong thing or had the wrong conversation. Because the typical response for that is we perceive that person doesn't like us anymore because of something we said. That's me focused, if that's how I'm navigating that. And if I'm speaking the truth pointedly, most of the time, it's because I want to feel right. I want to prove a point. I want to be heard. And again, that's me focused on me, and that's wrong. That's not the truth in love. That's the truth without any inclination of love. And we do it this way because we're scared. We're scared of who we are. We haven't believed the gospel, and we need to hear it again. We're concerned with our well-being, but we don't know who to turn to take care of us. And because of our self-centeredness and our sin, we're not capable of speaking the truth in love. But let me tell you something that is going to just blow your mind, hopefully. The gospel is Jesus speaking the most gut-wrenching, honest, brutal truth that has ever been communicated to humanity. Christianity is the religion that tells people the truth about who they are. And what it says is that we are broken without hope inside of ourselves, that we are so broken and so flawed that God had to come and rescue us by sacrificing his only son. Like, think about the implications there. When Jesus dies on the cross, he's telling you, you are a worst case scenario. Your life's a train wreck. There's no hope. And the only way to create hope is I have to do this. It has to be done this way. And it's going to be painful and it's going to be brutal. Like, that is Jesus being blatantly honest. Yet at the same time, he is affirming for the world, in the greatest way in which love has ever been affirmed, that he loves us so much that he was willing to die for us. The gospel is the perfect balance of truth and love. The gospel pointedly and openly addresses our flaws. It doesn't affirm our flaws, it addresses our flaws. It calls them out like they've never been called out before. But it affirms a love that's never been affirmed before. A love that can't go away, that never ends, that'll never be taken away from us. The gospel is Jesus telling us the truth and then being expelled so that we could be welcomed home. The gospel is Jesus telling us the truth and being rejected so that we could be accepted. The gospel is Jesus telling us the truth and then giving up, forfeiting the Father's love. He's crying out, my God, why have you forsaken me? He's giving up the Father's love so that we can have the Father's love. That's the gospel. That's truth and love. And we can't do that. So here, if the gospel has shaped you, if the gospel is shaping you and continues to shape you, know this, that its influence is more powerful than your family's influence, your country's influence, the influence of your colleagues, anything, any group that you've ever been a part of. Its influence is infinitely greater than that. And if the gospel is shaping us, we should be convinced that what God is doing is he's going to fit us together perfectly and uniquely so that we can be the people that we're called to be. So if the gospel is shaping us, we can be united in every way to Jesus and grow into the people that we're called to be. That's all I've got.